Well, good afternoon. It is a pleasure to be able to talk to you about the ballot propositions. It's not my first topic, but it's very pleasing to me that the chamber takes a strong interest in the issues that are coming before the public. I have to say, Wade, when you announced the October 3rd free subway, I was thinking to myself, too bad it isn't on Tuesday, and that you would simply require to get a free subway
I voted
sticker, because I can't think of anything that would up our dismal turnout than that, but a great idea. What I intend to do is just go through each of the propositions and turn perhaps provide a little background on them and then open up for your questions. I will say I do intend to editorialize somewhat on one, but I'll try and keep it to a dull roar on that subject. Also say in passing, it was kind of interesting. Kathy indicated that I'm coming to this at the last minute. I was doing a little research for an unrelated project earlier this week, which was looking at the history of the city and borough, and in particular looking at minutes from the September 1971 assembly, you know, the 40-year backcast. And it was kind of interesting to me to look at it. Many of you in the room will remember that at that point our city and borough of Juneau had been in existence only slightly more than a year. And two of the issues that they were dealing with in September of 1971 appear in some form on what we have on the ballot this October. The assembly was grappling with public disclosure laws and conflict of interest, and also trying to decide whether it was going to advance a proposition for a temporary sales tax onto the ballot, and in that case, the Augustus Brown swimming pool. So that brings me right to this year's ballot. We have five propositions that we're looking at, and the first happens to do with the municipal official financial disclosure. Now, the state legislature over the years has enacted basically two comprehensive disclosure law schemes that govern public officials and people seeking elective office. The first is the campaign disclosure laws, and it is for people who run for office, whether they're ultimately elected or not. This proposition has nothing to do with that. Those requirements will apply as they have since their inception to all local governments. The second, though, is one that requires financial disclosure of all significant financial and personal interests held by public officials. And that second disclosure scheme is really the subject of Proposition 1. Most of you will remember the corruption scandal in the state legislature that broke open between 2006 and 2007, and really triggered publicly by 20 federal search warrants that were issued against legislative offices in late August and early September in 2006. It's hard to believe it's just 5 years ago. But in an effort, I think, to deal both with the incredible damage done to the legislature's image, as well as, I think, a genuine recognition of the need for accountability of legislators and other state officials, the legislature enacted sweeping changes to both ethics and public disclosure laws. And they ended up being codified in probably the most comprehensive change since these schemes were developed, Chapter 47 of the Session Laws of Alaska, 2007. It covered a wide waterfront of issues, and some of them you may recall. They dealt with requiring ethics changing for training, for lobbyists, their employers, required or barred any person who had a felony from being able to lobby, It's barred spouses and domestic partners of legislators from being able to lobby the legislature. It instituted the so-called $15 rule, which is to say lobbyists couldn't spend more than $15 on a meal for a legislator. It required electronic filing of both campaign and financial disclosures, and imposed a new requirement that any official the executive branch, any elected official, be required to also file a disclosure statement 90 days after leaving office. It also famously barred use of state aircraft except for state business. That I think was probably one of the other insignificant but still highly publicized aspects of the legislation. But the fact of the matter is this public disclosure law not only was applied at the state level, but also to local government as well. However, the legislature provided an option to local governments, municipalities, to opt out of the state scheme on this condition that local voters approve the exemption in either a regular or special election. Proposition 1, if it is passed, would authorize Chino to opt out of the state scheme and simultaneously subject local public officials to a separate municipal official disclosure, financial disclosure law instead. I'm going to review with you just very briefly what I think are the significant differences. For the most part, the ordinance that would come into place would mirror the state law in effect prior to the 2007 changes. There's one exception. Under the prior law at the state level, the disclosure requirement required disclosure of income from whatever sources exceeding $5,000. The 2007 law lowered that to $1,000, and the Assembly, in putting this matter on the ballot, has retained that $1,000 threshold. The significant difference, and one of the points of controversy with regard to this change, is the 2007 amendments required not only the disclosure of the source of all income in excess of $1,000, it required you to state, it does require you to state the amount. And our ordinance, in reverting back to the former scheme, simply requires you to disclose the source of the income, but not the specific amount. The scheme that is incorporated in Proposition 1 would eliminate the requirement of filing a post-term disclosure statement, and again, returning to the prior state scheme. State law also has an extensive administrative process. In terms of complaints that are processed by the Alaska Public Offices Commission, I dare say every one of you has heard of APOC. We don't have a parallel provision in the proposed city ordinance. Instead, its enforcement would be left to other mechanisms. They're primarily criminal prosecution for violations, forfeiture of office, and the right of any citizen to bring a suit challenging the conduct of any city official. And I should say, who's subject to it? Under current state law, under the older state law, and under this ordinance, the people who must file are assembly members, school board members, members of the Planning Commission, and the city borough manager. Those are the officials that are subject to this law. In my view, the challenge has been, and I think it's reflected in every effort here, how do you maintain the balance between the public's legitimate concern that a public official exercise his or her duties with impartiality and, most importantly, devoid of any conflict of interest against that official's right to privacy, one that is admittedly less extensive than a private citizen's. My experience, particularly as mayor over the last several years, and being a person who has encouraged countless individuals to consider running for office, has led me to conclude that to the extent that, my sense that the current state scheme really is a major impediment to people who would be excellent public officials, who are truly outstanding leaders in their own spheres, but they're simply not prepared to bear every aspect of their personal finances to the public. And I don't think it's good enough to simply say that's the price you pay for running for public office, which is the primary rejoinder that I hear. I think we have to reframe our thinking on this. It seems to me that in a democracy, you start off from the premise that every citizen should be prepared to do his or her duty, which includes being prepared to run for public office. It shouldn't be something we think in terms of a select few. It shouldn't be limited to people who are primarily retired or have an independent source of income. So, to my mind, the question is, what is it that the average citizen should be prepared to disclose in running for office and meet that threshold of information to satisfy his or her peers with regard to any specific matter that citizen is able to decide the public's interest without a conflict of interest? I have distributed several copies of two documents that should be on each table here, and I'm going to ask you to peruse them during the course of my remarks here. One is the current disclosure form in blank, along with copies of my own most recent disclosure statement. Simply ask you to do this. I'd like you just to review the form and complete it in your own mind. Some of you may want to fill it out. That might be even a greater exercise. But then ask yourself, am I willing to serve? So let me move to the second proposition, and that is extending the temporary 3% tax. Most of the revenues that are needed to run the city government's core functions are derived from three sources: property taxes, investment income, and sales taxes. So the sales taxes really account for about a quarter of our general government operations. And under our charter, all sales taxes must be approved by the voters in elections. Our current 5% city sales tax is a direct result of those approvals. Those taxes, in turn, are really broken into three elements. We have a 1% permanent sales tax, which has been incorporated into the charter, and is used to support general government operations. We have a second 1% temporary sales tax that will expire on September 30th of next, actually 2013. And it has been dedicated to specific construction projects. Just to run through them, they include the Public Works Consolidated Facility, the continuation of the area-wide sewer and water projects, the the airport renovation in Stater Harbor. Those are the primary uses of that temporary sales tax. And then we come to the sales tax that we're asking voters to approve this year. It's the temporary 3% sales tax, which is due to expire on June 30th of next year, 2012. And it consists, everything is done in threes here. 1% of that sales tax is directed at government operations. The second is used for capital improvements, primarily streets and sidewalks. And the third one is, in some respects, a catch-all. We use it for some capital projects, for some operating expenses. We use it to support youth activities. And we also have used it specifically to help build our emergency budget reserve. So now let me turn to the propositions 3 and 4. They really relate to the school bonds. So I'll start with a couple preliminary comments about them. Under our charter, the school board is required to make recommendations to the assembly about all school-related capital projects, construction projects. And there's a second requirement that is triggered by state law, that is, to the extent the city is interested in seeking state funds, we have to submit, that is to say, the school board is required to submit a six-year CIP plan. And again, it's a condition precedent for receiving any state funding. I can tell you that in any given year, and Mary can certainly second me on this, the list is extensive. Our capital project needs to keep and maintain quality school facilities is an expensive proposition. Just to talk about the most recent submission for FY12, the district's proposal for that 1 year adds up to a little over $42 million. At the same time, the school district has recognized the assembly's real concern about voter fatigue and seeing major projects on the ballot for schools every year. And for that reason, the district submitted only two small requests for this year's ballot. And each of them have already been determined by the State Department of Education that it is eligible for state debt reimbursement of 70%. Of the cost, and that's making the assumption that the legislature will fully fund the reimbursement program, which it has done consistently for the last 20 years. So the first of the bond issues is authorizing $1.4 million in GO bonds for a ground source heating system at the Ock Bay School. You may recall that last year voters approved Proposition 1 on the 2010 ballot, which authorized a little over $18 million for renovating the Ock Bay School. At that point, ground source heating was not part of the plan, but our recent experience with ground source heating at the airport and combined with our recent implementation of the same ground source heating at the pool left the school board and ultimately the assembly to the conclusion that we should include the technology at the Ock Bay School. It will replace an oil-fired boiler and thus will eliminate the need for use of fossil fuels in as the primary heating system. There will be a backup electric boiler. When staff looked at the matter, they recognized that in terms of the life cycle cost of using a oil-fired burner versus ground source heat pump systems, they were virtually identical. There were much higher costs with regard to the initial construction cost and a much lower cost for ongoing maintenance and operations with regard to the ground source heat pump system. But the dynamics changed once you factored in the 70% debt reimbursement from the state. We expect that with use of the ground source heat pump, we will save an average of $35,000 a year. And it also means that we will be less dependent on what has historically been very volatile price swings in heating oil. And just a little aside about Diamond Park's pool, again, it's doing much better than expected, and it's been proving to be truly a remarkable use of the system, but we've yet to have a winner. And so I would say the overall judgment is still out on its overall efficiency on a year-round basis. Proposition 4 is the authorization of about $1.2 million for replacement of the turf surfacing at Adair Kennedy. And most of you know that that field is probably the most heavily used of our recreation facilities in Juneau. And its synthetic turf is far past its useful life. I know there's been a lot of discussion about the vandalism that took place, got a lot of media coverage earlier this year, but it wasn't a precipitating factor in the school board's request nor in the assembly's decision to place the matter on the ballot. The fibers have been severely worn across broad areas of the field, and it just doesn't support the rubber infill pellets underneath, which is crucial, again, for protection against falls. We've also, over the years, added rubber pellets, but again, we're finding that because of the damage of the fibers, they're just not holding the infill. This appropriation will only take care of the surface. The sub-drain system is adequate and will remain in place. The proposed new surface is several generations newer than the existing system, and the assumption is that it will have a useful life of somewhere between 10 and 15 years. Simply put, this is just a judgment about protecting children from injury. So that brings me to the last one here, and I'm sure you're getting tired of this recitation, but it is the Proposition 5, and it is the initiative petition amending the code by adding a tax of 15 cents per bag on all plastic shopping bags provided by certain retailers. That's the proposition as it's stated. The initiative and referendum procedures in our charter are actually a direct descendant of a movement in the late 1800s, running into the early 1900s, the progressive movement. And it was intended primarily to bypass what was then believed as corrupt state legislatures and councils, and so that laws could be enacted that were otherwise being blocked. And it was seen at the time of our constitutional convention as one of the more forward-looking measures that should be included in keeping government connected to the people. But it was also one of the most extensively discussed, and as it ultimately turned out, the most controversial article in our state constitution. It became Article 11, and it was a variant of that bypass that was incorporated into our 1970 charter. The charter provides that any five registered voters in Juneau may initiate a petition. They have 30 days to gather signatures of qualified voters equal to 25% of those who voted in our last municipal election. Once those names have been reviewed, if it's found to meet those requirements, the city clerk is required to submit the matter to the assembly. And the assembly has basically two choices. It can on its own decide to enact that initiative as law, decline to do so, in which case it goes on to the ballot. And that's the action that leads us to the proposition now on the October 4th ballot. As I described earlier, would impose a 15% tax on every plastic bag that is provided to a shopper by a retailer who has, on average, for the last 5 years, had gross sales of $15 million or more. And according to the petitioners, that tax means it would be applied to any shoppers at Safeway, Walmart, Home Depot, and Fred Meyer. So that is my rundown of the ballot. And Jim, I see your hands up. You're first out of the...
On this 70% rebate back from the state, is that going to go to pay off this $1.4 million, or is that just a windfall for the city?
No, it has to be directed. The payment, first of all, only comes at the point that we have already expended the money. The money will come back to the state treasury. It's generally applied, again, to retire other debt. I wouldn't call it a windfall at all.
As to the plastic bag tax, I know when a state petition to advance an initiative goes forward, Lieutenant Governor has to have the Department of Law assess the legal merit of the legal basic soundness. Did Mr. Hartle's office look at the bag tax? Because I'm wondering how equal protection of the law is being afforded to Fred Meyer, Walmart, and the other two big retailers, and why the bags they give out are more harmful to the environment than the bags given out at smaller retailers. I don't know if anyone's looked at that issue. It just kind of seems odd to me.
And Ben, we have a parallel circumstance. Actually, the way it generally works is that the lieutenant governor has to approve as to form, which, generally speaking, can involve questions of constitutionality. But for the most part, the recent trend in the law is that if it meets the form, that is, you've done the petition, it's truly the right paperwork is there, it's attached. And if it isn't on its face, contrary to some state constitutional principle, a dedication of a fund, for example, the tendency is to allow the matter to go to the ballot. And only if it passes, then do you have the legal challenge that will come about its constitutionality. And that's essentially the way it works at the city level as well. The clerk determined that it was sufficient as to form. She did consult with the attorney to confirm that, but did not go to the question which most assuredly will be out there in the event the measure passes. Why is it that way? Well, in part, it's a recognition of judicial economy. Courts should not have to decide a case that may not ultimately prove to be even there. So if the voters turn this down, there's no reason for the courts to get involved. Asking them to do it at this stage, particularly in the press of time between placement on the ballot and the election itself, can lead to both improvident decisions, but most importantly, a potential waste of judicial resources, which the courts are very concerned about. Eric?
I had a question about the disclosure stuff. It sounds like if we don't do what we've been doing, we flip over to a set system, or is there some more latitude that we have?
The answer is we are in the state system right now, and we'll continue to be that unless there is a unless this proposition passes, in which case there is the local scheme, which, as I described, is based on the pre-2007 state disclosure requirements, with the one exception that the disclosure requirement is at 1,000 rather than 5,000.
I guess what I'm wondering is, can we do much tinkering at our level?
We may not. Yes, ma'am.
The bag tax again. Is it 15% of what?
No, it's 15 cents.
15 cents, I think.
Per bag. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I may have said that, and if I did, I missed
one.
Lori.
Yeah, thanks for on that again, too. The 15 cents per bag, that's assessed to the consumer. Is that correct? And then the consumer pays that at the end of the deal. Where are those funds going? And is some of that staying at the retailer? For administrative costs, you know, I see it as a good deterrent to using plastic, and I don't have a problem paying that if I forget my recyclable bags. I have no problem doing that. But I have a problem voting on it without knowing where the money's going to go.
It is a tax, which means that the retailer is required to collect and required to remit, just as any other tax at the local level. So there's nothing that in the proposition that calls for covering of administrative costs of the retailer, for example. It is simply just as we expect a retailer to collect the normal sales tax. It is a cost of doing business which we don't offset as a local government.
Who's going to monitor the use of bags?
Well, again, just as we, in terms of sales tax, we rely on merchants, wherever they are, to collect the right amount of taxes. And we work on the assumption that overwhelming majority of our taxpayers and tax collectors, in this case retailers, will do so honestly. And they do. Lorraine. The proposition itself doesn't direct the money anywhere. In fact, it would be improper for it to do so. I, again, take it that the primary purpose here is a deterrent to the use of plastic bags. And so I would say, the objective in terms of how the monies are disposed of. That would be left ultimately to the assembly if the matter passes.
Yeah, Bruce, I was in Whitehorse a little while ago, and I run into that problem in the store. And if you don't buy the bag, or 5 cents up there, you just don't get any bag. It's up to you to pack your own groceries up.
And I'm sure you did. Yes.
Bruce, thank you for the summary. On the 15 cent a bag, if in fact the initiative passes and it becomes law, who has to defend that in court if there is a challenge to, as Ben points out, probably in my opinion, pretty valid argument on the disparity of the size of the grocery store? But will that become the city's liability?
It becomes the city's obligation to defend, because it is, in essence, becomes an ordinance like any other, and for which the municipal attorney is charged to defend. Mr. Blasco.
Is there any reuse of the turf field once it's taken out of the turf? Can it be used on any other fields, such as diamond softball? Or
I don't know the answer, but I'll venture an opinion. Not knowing has never been an impediment to me to venture to make one, which is, given the concern about the quality and of the current turf, the changes, not least of which is a concern about liability, my suspicion is that there will be a reticence to allow it to be reused somewhere else. Now, there may be portions that are salvageable. I don't know the answer, and I think that's a question that I would direct initially to our staff.
We can see your wheels turning, though.
Always.
I know it.
Bruce, on the football field, too, I'm understanding that replacement the desire to replace field preceded the vandalism. I'm just curious, is there any insurance or anything that covers that helps mitigate the cost of, or that would go towards the new field?
The overall cost to repair from the vandalism was about $20,000, so it was a mere drop in the bucket, and that's something that's well within our own self-insured limits.
Okay.